to Curmudgeon's Corner. It is Wednesday, March 19th, 2014, just after 2 UTC, not 3 UTC, because of that savings time thing.
Oh, God. Now, did you do your rant last week on that?
I did a rant on that last week. I did the required one, so you don't have to join in, although
beautiful.
I know you're tempted. As you can hear, Yvonne Bo is back with us again. After last week, we failed to do the show live from Puerto Rico.
It just wasn't going to work. It just wasn't going to work. My son was sleep schedule was completely
off
by the whole trip. We were having dinners very late and stuff or whatever. It was just it just wasn't going to work.
A few weeks ago, you mentioned how you'd been looking at the satellite views of your old house there. Did you, in fact, visit it?
I did not, actually. We didn't even have time for that, actually. Didn't have time. I wound up doing a whole bunch of other stuff, but just couldn't. I tried to take some time, but just couldn't squeeze it in.
So we have a limited number of topics this week. As most of you have followed, in the last week, the speculation about this missing plane has continued and gone, it's just pure speculation everywhere. A few spattered facts here and there. Anyway, it's blown up. We'll talk about it. We'll talk about it in a minute. And of course, the situation in Ukraine has continued to develop. We'll talk about that some. Those are the two big topics. And frankly, they will probably take most of an hour, if not all of the hour, between those two things. But first, and I had a couple other things, I wanted to mention. There was the thing about the NSA capturing the entire phone traffic of a country and keeping it for 30 days, which is kind of interesting. But I know Yvonne's kind of bored with the surveillance thing. So
yeah, whatever. Nobody cares anymore. I'm wondering what. Nobody gives a shit. I mean, really, nobody gives a shit.
I give a shit, but
let me change. Of course, being my exaggerated self, a significant part of the American population that doesn't care.
Yeah, and of course, with this particular revelation, that which countries are involved has not been disclosed. But you got to bet it's like Afghanistan or something, right? If it's Afghanistan or some country like that, then or Yemen or whatever,
or Iraq or something, right?
Most of Americans are going to go, okay, that's fine with me. In fact, that sounds like a good thing.
That sounds like a good thing, right?
Because then we'll be able to figure out what's going on there a lot better than we would otherwise. And I understand that sentiment, but at the same time, I'm like, I don't care if it's the Russians, the Iraqis, the Syrians, our most committed enemies in the whole world. We should be, targeted, not let's grab everything. Because even if country X is our sworn enemy, each individual person in country X is not. But, I know everyone will say that's idealistic, that's bullshit, they're doing it, why shouldn't we, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, we are not going to talk about that. At least not this week. We probably won't get around to talking about Google's announcement of this new LG Google Watch and a new operating system for wearables and blah, blah, blah. That happened this week, too.
That happened this week. I mean, I did, apparently it landed like a big thud
It happened today.
In the last 24 hours. I was on the news today reading even the tech news. I mean, geez, I didn't see that. Okay.
Yes, so, LG, and Google announced a new Google Watch that's being built by LG, and they announced a new version of Android specifically designed for wearables, and I guess there's another kind that's going to be, a couple other manufacturers are on board to make them soon.
Okay,
All right. And so, anyway.
Blood testing, blah, blah, blah. Jeez, okay. Well, I'm sure it was announced, but I guess a lot of people didn't really care. Okay.
Anyway, so before we get
the tech news that I saw today. Okay, oh, there it is. LG to launch G Watch with Android Wear. But you see, I saw it more as an LG launch. I guess when I saw it, that's why I didn't care. I saw it more as an LG launch instead of, Google unveils Android Wear. It's modified OS for wearables. So that was like sometime this morning. But I'll tell you, as a higher headline, which, by the way, it's not like it's a great headline. I mean, it's just silly headline. Was something about this 8 gigabyte iPhone 5C that was launched.
Was it actually announced? I read speculation on it.
Yeah. No. It's launched. Yeah, but it's just, which is like, really, who cares? And also I saw this other announcement that they killed finally the iPad 2 and that they replaced it with
the 4.
The right.
Exactly. That is another one where I saw the rumor that they were going to do it, but never saw the confirmation.
And also, iOS 7.1 came out.
Oh, that came out a while ago. Yeah, I've been running that.
A while ago? Like
a week.
Like a week. Right. It's not a while ago. It's been the last week.
That's ancient news.
Boy, jeez.
And it's not like it's iOS 7. It's 7.1.
I know. It's 7.1.
Me up when it's iOS 8.
Yeah. I hear you. I mean, it's, just, you know, but still. Anyway,
I mean, I launched it. There are a few minor changes, whatever. You know, nothing. Anyway, the light and fruity thing that we were going to talk about before we get to the meteor things is a follow-up. A few weeks back, I mentioned, and Yvonne had not heard of yet, Warren Buffett's announcement that he was going to do a $1 billion prize for someone who got the NCAA bracket completely correct.
Now let's be correct here. It is really a contest run by Yahoo, sponsored by Yahoo and Quicken Loans. What Warren Buffett is doing is that he is selling them he owns very large insurance companies, through his insurance subsidiary, is selling the insurance to do the payoff in case somebody were to win.
Yes.
Right.
What would happen? Your particular bracket, because you went through this process. A number of people have figured out the odds here. Now, first of all, the roughest possible estimate you get, which is a really bad estimate, by the way, is if you picked completely at random, like you didn't have any basketball knowledge, you just picked completely at random, you would have a 1 in 9.2 quintillion chance of winning. That's a 9, or to be more specific.
I know, I read it through the rules.
If
and
we
I got
read
to
the
that
number, 9223-372-036-854-780-000. Okay.
That was pretty high. That's pretty long odds. Yes.
Yes. Now,
but here's the thing.
Now, if you have...
You don't have to pay to do it. All I did was...
You don't have to pay money. You have to pay in time, and you have to pay in information that you provide them.
Okay, yeah. The information, I had to... Okay, now that was quite... my name, my address, my consent to be marketed, and I had a choice of like either creating a Yahoo account... Which I'm like, why the hell? Well, actually, it did wind up forcing me to create a Yahoo account anyway. Yep. But then it said something, well, you can log on through Facebook or Google. And I'm like, wait a minute, if I'm creating, which was utterly confusing to me. I'm like, how the hell am I logging in through Google or Facebook if I'm creating a Yahoo account? Just the whole thing, just that part of the sign up made no sense. And I saw the rules. I said, well, I'll do the Facebook one. And the Facebook had said, well, you're going to get, we need to know all your friends. We're going to get all this and we're going to get all this. I said, screw that. I said, no. I went through the Google one. It said, well, we're going to pull this and this information. The thing is, in my Google account, I got nothing. So I was like, screw it. Pull whatever the hell you want on a Google account. I don't care. All right. So I used that one. Okay. So that was irritating. And then I spent a few minutes picking the games. Total time for me to do this, 10 minutes.
See, now, the expected value, though, even if you... So, now, I mentioned the odds if you don't have any basketball knowledge. If you have if you're very smart about it, given all the team's rankings and blah, 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 and their chances of winning and blah, 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 you can reduce it down to 1 in 6 billion or so.
1 in 6 billion? Okay. Okay.
You probably heard 1 in 100 billion.
Yeah.
Around that range. And that is if you have some basketball knowledge. Like if you're really, really smart about it, though, you can get it down to 1 in 6 billion or so. I'm judging this by the latest that Nate Silver posted on his new website, which, by the way, Nate Silver's new website is up. And he actually says about 1 in 7 billion, 7.4 billion.
Okay. It's not that crazy.
If you use that kind of estimate versus the payoff, the expected value of going through this exercise is 17 cents. So the question is the time you put into it and the information you gave away worth more or less than 17 cents for you?
I was feeling sick. I didn't have anything else to do.
Okay.
So, yeah. I mean, if I wasn't doing that, what the hell I'd be doing? Scratching my balls for, 10 minutes? Who knows? I don't know. I was bored. I had the time. So, I mean, the return I was going to get on that time when I did it was zero.
So now,
therefore, yes.
Now, Yvonne, you asked me a number of weeks ago if I won the Mega Millions or whatever, would you get any? And I said, I would, of course, take you to lunch, Yvonne. So I'm requesting here, if you win the billion, I would like to have lunch.
Which, by the way, the cash payout is 500 million.
Yes.
Okay. All right. I will say this. If I win the 500 million, I guarantee you will get a much more generous, given that you are my curmudgeon quarter, okay, let's face it. We've been doing this gig for how long? If we add the Carnegie Mellon years?
Yeah, a long time.
I guarantee you I will get you something far more generous than a lunch.
More than lunch? You're very generous there. Now, the other thing here is, and I'm, of course, joking around here, but Buffett has said, though, in one of the interviews about this, that if it looked like someone was close to getting the billion, like, say they still had everything right when it was down to the final four, he would offer them a payout. He would say, I'll give you 50 million right now to drop out.
Wow.
And so the question is, like, would you take that payout given your odds are still pretty low?
Yes. Yes. I'd take the 50. Actually, I'd make him pay. Give me 100.
You'd negotiate.
I'd negotiate. I mean, yeah.
Because, of course, chances, even if you're like at the final four to final eight and you've got everything right, you've got like a really low chance of actually getting all the way.
Yeah, because the problem is that you pick them in advance. And that's the thing. OK, like I've gone through the NFL playoff bracket and I've picked I've done like in the last 5 years, I've picked the perfect NFL playoff bracket. Now, the NFL playoff bracket is only 16 teams. Yes. This is 64. Yes. But I've picked that bracket perfectly, okay? I mean, it sure as hell, and that was even tougher because it was against a point spread. So I had to, I had to pick the winner to the margin of victory. I don't have to pick the margin of victory over here.
Right.
I mean, if I got a guaranteed 50 million right now or like zero, like 2 weeks, I'd take the 50 million. The hell? I would take less if I get a guaranteed payout because there were some second and third prizes that were like about $100,000 or something or whatever.
Yeah.
But Jesus, I mean, 100,000 versus 50 million. Shit.
Yeah. And I forget exactly what number he said. It was a fairly large payout, but like nowhere near a billion.
I hear you. I can see that. Now, listen, there have been people that have picked the perfect bracket. It's not like it hasn't happened.
No. Okay. It has not.
Okay.
For the NCAA, it has not.
Okay.
As far as anybody can tell, that has never happened.
I thought I heard a couple of years ago that there was a person who picked the perfect bracket.
In the stuff I've read about this, it's
never, nobody has ever had.
Yeah, I mean, I could be wrong here, but I've read several articles about this, and you'd think if anybody had actually ever done this, it would have been mentioned prominently. And I think, in fact, the opposite has been mentioned.
Okay, I could be wrong. Maybe it wasn't a perfect bracket. It was just, you know, very close. You know, hey, all I did, I had a few minutes. I took a shot. What the hell? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. See, I didn't. I was like, no.
The tournament hasn't started yet.
No, I'm still not going to. Look, here's the deal. Like, okay, yes, I know. If you don't play, you have no chance of winning. But I'm like, you just described, like, spending 10 minutes on this. I don't want to spend 10 minutes on this. And even more to the point, I don't want to, like, I don't want to create the Yahoo account. I used to have a Yahoo account, but it's probably expired at this point. And I don't want to, like, they say right up front, they want to use this information for marketing. I don't want any more marketing. There is a significant actual cost to doing this. It may not be in dollars, but it's in inconvenience and in, you know, people are going to bother you with marketing spam for the rest of your life. And, you know, I'm sure they're going to spam me anyway because they have my information anyway. But it's still like, I don't want to encourage that. And it's not like, you know, and there is no chance to win. I mean, I know there's a mathematical chance to win, but...
Okay, by the way, there is on ESPN,
yes.
They're just mentioning here that in 2010, an autistic teen did pick a perfect bracket.
Okay, is he playing this time?
I don't know, but there is a kid. It says, who did it? His name is Alex Herman. He's a 17-year-old student at Glenbrook South High School in Glenview, Illinois. Okay?
Yeah, I'm looking at the article from 2010.
So, yes. I told you, I said there was somebody to pick one, and yes, it has been done. So what do you want me to tell you?
Oh, wait.
Now I think there's some dispute about it, whether it was or not.
Yeah. But so I'm looking at the article I see here.
I've seen two articles that confirm that give that name.
No, I see the articles, but it's okay. Here you go. Alex Herman, the autistic kid with perfect bracket, no longer has perfect bracket. He made it part way. Let's see. He went. Alex is on top of me again here. Saw his flawless guessing streak go by the wayside when Butler dismissed Syracuse. So he had a perfect bracket part of the way through, after at least the first round, but it didn't continue. He didn't make it all the way.
Okay.
So he might have gotten like,
but he might have gotten the Buffett offer.
I know. I don't think it went that far. It looks like it. It only went. The opening round, or maybe the second round. I can't see for sure. So, with everybody barking and Alex climbing to the top of my bookshelf again, let's take a break, and we'll be back, and we'll start talking about the missing airplane. Sounds good, Yvonne?
Sure.
Okay, back after this. Okay, I'm back at my seat. Yvonne, you still there?
Uh-huh.
Oh, yes.
I have an awful cold, so I don't know. It's been lucky that I haven't been coughing and sneezing during the show. Coffee. Because I have been doing that all day, and I have not been during the show, so we're doing good so far.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I almost thought of telling you, dude, I mean, I may be sneezing during the whole show. It may not be such a good idea for me to, but I haven't.
You've managed.
I've managed, so that's good news. They blew my nose.
Yeah. Beautiful. We'll clip that out and use it as one of the breaks.
No, great. There you go. Beautiful. Great idea.
Maybe repeat it 5 or 10 times. Ugh. Put pitch blend it a few times so that you snuffle into a song or something.
Great.
Anyway, since we have determined that Yvonne is definitely going to win the $1 billion bracket and be generous to me and all Curmudgeon's Corner listeners, probably.
No.
No? No?
Okay. I don't know. I'll tell you what. I'll do a get together of all of those who actually listen to the show and let me know, and we'll do a very nice get together. How's that?
I think you should restrict that to people who let you know that they listen before you win.
Before I win, right. Good point. So you got to tweet us or send us a tweet saying that you listened to this episode. Okay. And yes, and we'll use that as a confirmation. Yes.
Yeah, there you go. Anyway, there's a missing plane. Beep, beep, beep. This is Future Sam. As I am assembling the podcast together in order to put it out, which is Thursday around 4 UTC, there's breaking news about this plane that the Australians found something on satellite imagery that might be related to the plane southwest of Australia, and their plane's flying out to investigate it, and blah, blah, blah. Certainly, as we recorded this, that was not yet something anybody knew, and even as I am putting this together, it's unknown whether this will be confirmed to be part of the plane or not confirmed to be part of the plane, or if it is, what the cause was, and all that kind of stuff. But nevertheless, this is a fast-moving story. For the next however long part of this podcast, Yvonne and I talk about the missing plane and possibilities of what could or could not have happened and blah, 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 which may very well be completely invalidated by the moving events between when we recorded it and when you're listening to this. Hey, that's what happens. In any case, you'll hear our speculation, and if you know for a fact, based on what's happened since then, that what is being said is completely and totally wrong, hey, just laugh at us. Hey, that's the way it works. In any case, back to Yvonne and I talking about the missing plane MH370 and doing the best we could to speculate given the knowledge we had at the time. Here you go. Oh yeah. Boo boo boo. I talked about it a bit last week, but I mainly said, you know, there's a lot of speculation. I'm going to avoid too much of that. And I concentrated on just sort of like, oh my God, how much would it suck to be one of the family members here, given all the back and forth on this thing?
Oh my God, yeah. And all the bullshit stories. My God. I mean, Jesus. But, I mean, I was getting really irritated with Sam because there's a story by this guy who calls himself a pilot.
I want to be clear, and I tweeted this as well. I have tweeted probably a half dozen different theories about this. I am not endorsing any single one of them.
I wasn't irritated with you. That stupid story got picked up by a lot of people. And I mean, it's just the guy is talking out of his ass. I mean,
just to be clear, everybody, this particular story theorized that basically there was a fire. The pilot aimed the plane. Let me just explain at a very high level. The theory that Yvonne is angry at is a theory that basically there was a fire on the plane. The pilot turned the plane to aim at the closest available airport that had a good easy runway to run at, and then the smoke overcame the passengers and crew. They all died, And then the plane continued on autopilot for hours after that and is probably somewhere in the Indian Ocean at this point once it exhausted its fuel. That was the basics of the theory that Yvonne is upset about. Just to, yeah, and we'll undoubtedly talk about some of the other theories in just a few minutes, but first let's let Yvonne rant against this one.
Well, I mean, let's talk about, look, I was making a calculation today. The 777-200 and 200ER, okay, this is an ER version. I personally have flown that on that plane at least 100 times, I figured, today. It is the plane that I've flown on the most, okay? I'm pretty familiar with the plane. I actually have a pilot's license, okay, all right? I'm not multi-engine, but I'm one of the things that I do, my wife thinks I'm insane, is that I read all these books, watch all these programs, and read all this stuff about aircraft accidents. My wife keeps driving me crazy because I record like all the episodes of air disasters on National Geographic Channel.
Which is a perfect show for someone who flies a lot.
Yeah, and my wife, well, the thing is that my wife is like a very nervous flyer. All right. So we were traveling like a week. Every time that I'm watching that show, or my wife is walking into the living room, I have to turn the show away. Okay. Let me put it this way. Last week, when we were flying back from San Juan on Sunday, we took off. Perfect flight, no problem. We hit a little bit of turbulence. She got so scared, she freaking gripped my. I mean, she almost like sprained my wrist. How hard she gripped me. I mean, she wasn't even holding my hand. She was sitting there, and all of a sudden, she got scared, and she went and just grabbed my wrist and just crunched it. And I'm like, Jesus Christ. I'm like, what the hell? What? We just hit turbulence a little bit. So, but I, you know, look, I have studied air accidents intensively. I mean, it's just... I've read books about it.
It's one of your hobbies. It's one of your interests.
One of my hobbies is to study air accidents, okay? And, okay, so let's go through some of these facts. Like, for example, like this guy who wrote this idiotic story, all right, okay? First of all, okay, he goes and he says a fire developed on the plane that was caused by the nose gear landing gear. That tire exploding, getting hot, and then it going and closing. They go and they close the landing gear up, and it caused a fire that, oh, by the way, the first thing that it hit is the communications. Okay, all right, apparently, according to him. Now, this, and he referenced an old accident from like 30 years ago, which was a DC-8 flying from Mecca, if I remember correctly, that was carrying pilgrims, okay, that on takeoff, okay, the plane went and had a couple of tires in the main carriage blow. At that the tires, they went, then they closed the landing gear, and that when the tires blew, these tires were very worn. This airline had a very poor safety record. Okay, the wheel had run on the tarmac. It was a very hot day. The heat went and just went in through the cabin, started a fire. The pilots declared an emergency. They tried to turn back. They couldn't get back in time, and the plane crashed short of returning to the runway where it took off from. Now, here's one thing. What he didn't realize is, or I don't know if he has studied it or he just ignored it and thinks this is impossible. That accident caused, okay, almost all modern airliners and private jets now to have fire detection and fire suppression systems in the landing gear. So if you went and say you closed the damn thing, the damn system would have fired an alarm immediately on takeoff saying, shit, you got a problem with a tire. It's on fire. Okay? So what is he telling me? So the fire system on the whole plane just shot too? So wait a minute. First we got, okay, so there, and oh, by the way, it took 45 minutes? No. There is no way that he's going to tell me that the entire fire suppression system on the damn plane just completely failed. Okay? And by the way, oh, the fire suppression system completely failed, but yet it didn't. It managed somehow to later extinguish the fire, so the plane didn't explode later and managed to fly for 7 hours. How the hell did it disable them, go on that long, but not consume the plane and crash it beforehand and let it fly for 7 hours? It's nonsense. There is, listen, and here's the bigger problem. The front tire popping on a plane, okay? No, that doesn't happen. When you're on takeoff, okay, and you hit those thrusters to max, okay, the weight on the plane shifts towards the back, okay? It goes and it takes the pressure off the front tire, okay? It is the one that has the least load, okay? So there is no way that's what caused it, okay? All right? So first I got to have a tire that never pops pop, okay? All right, number one. Then I have to have the entire fire system in a 777 fail, okay? And then I got to have, even if then after it failed, oh, by the way, it went and like it made it that the first things that it knocked out ACARS and it knocked out VHF, but it didn't knock out other communication systems in the plane that were sending signals. Wow. Jeez, what a freaking coincidental fire. That fire is a genius. Okay? And oh, by the way, even though there was a fire that killed everybody on the plane managed to fly for 7 hours. Oh, by the way, the first thing that the pilots didn't do in an emergency, because I've been in an in-flight emergency on a 777, they didn't dump the fuel, okay? Which, by the way, comes from another, something that happened since since Swiss Air flight in Newfoundland crashed, which is another in-flight fire, okay, that happened. One of the three biggest ones that have happened. That plane wound up coming back to Nova Scotia. They discovered a fire. They were on the air for a very long time. They declared an emergency. But the one thing is that when they were about to land, the pilots went and said, oh, shit, we didn't dump the fuel. We may have a problem when we land. Let's dump the fuel. They decided to go and circle dump the fuel. When they did that, by the way, they took so much time that apparently the fire incapacitated the crew and they crashed, okay? Yeah. Since then, they changed procedures for that. They went and almost every airline right now dumps the fuel immediately. So first thing you do when you're in the emergency. And oh, by the way, okay, you know what? In the 777 I was, they went and we didn't have enough time to dump all the fuel. So they went and they landed anyway. So there was fire equipment waiting because they said the pilots went and said, you know what? We're dumping fuel, but we may not dump it all in time. So we're not going to dick around with it. We're bringing this plane down right now. So you know what? We're going to come in with a lot of fuel, okay, because we're flying from Sao Paulo to New York City. So we were loaded with fuel, and we're going to come down no matter what, okay? So if the tires pop, there's going to be emergency equipment on the ground. So the story that this guy concocted, that it's his theory, it makes no sense. He's saying that the pilots didn't follow any of the standard procedures for emergencies. He's saying that they had a fire that went and failed to be detected by all the fire detection systems on the plane or suppression systems. Okay. I mean, basically the biggest, most incredible electronic failure of a 777 ever had to happen.
Okay.
So, all right, so that theory is bullshit. Okay,
let's move on from that theory.
Let's go on to all the other ones.
Let's talk about let's go from your theory of the rest of the theories besides that one. Pick like three more, and go from what you think is the least likely, and let's end with what you think is the most likely.
You know what? The thing is that I just don't know what the heck is the most likely. I think that I mean, this is like, you might as well be throwing darts at the wall. You know, here's a problem, right? The information we've got, they were talking about that the plane kept changing altitudes up and down.
Yeah.
I really think that the altitude changes on the plane either didn't happen or were far more subtle than what they saw. Okay.
So you think that's misinterpreting the radar signals that they were basing?
It's not misinterpreting radar signals. Radar is not very good at picking up altitude.
That's what I mean.
That is the reason why the transponders send the altitude information down. Years ago, there was an accident in Brazil, okay, where an Embraer private jet, a Legacy, clipped the wing of a Gol 737 that was flying in an opposite direction. They, by accident, got assigned to the same altitude in different directions. The Legacy, the reason why the TCAS didn't warn them was because for some reason this new plane, somebody made a mistake and shut off the transponder, okay, on the Legacy. And so the private jet was flying, and the aviation authorities were saying, well, you're flying erratically all over the altitudes because that's what the military radar said. Well, they pulled the cockpit recorder off the Legacy, and guess what? They hadn't changed altitude at all. But the ground information said that they did. So I'm gonna take that, given how inaccurate that kind of radar is for altitude, that information is not reliable, and we shouldn't take that as a fact that the plane changed altitudes drastically one way or another. Okay.
Now, to be clear, you're saying that's unreliable. It doesn't mean it didn't happen, but it doesn't mean it did either.
But that's not a good information to go on that did actually happen.
Right. Okay. So in other words, we just have no fucking idea about that part.
We have no idea about that. They've come up with all these theories. Look, like the theory about it following another 777 to hide its radar signal. You know what? That's very doable. I gotta be honest with you. You know the flight schedules. Singapore Airlines is the largest operator of 777s. They certainly, you know, have a lot flying out of Singapore at night, doing overnight flights at those times. Okay, if you wanted to go and hide yourself, to go somewhere, and you knew the schedules, and you know that, you know, Singapore Airlines has the largest 777 fleet in the world. Obviously you would pick to try to fly, you know, to pick something flying out of Singapore to go out, the more like there'll be a 777. The radar blips probably would merge. Nobody would notice. I mean, you could fly relatively close to it. Of course, at some point
you'd have to separate.
At some point you'd have to separate, but if you were...
You do it a long way in between airports where nobody's paying much attention or something.
Exactly. Nobody's going to be paying that much attention to a blip with, like, no transponder information on it.
Again, depending on where, like, because, a number of countries, for instance, the civilian radar aren't going to be paying much attention, but the military radar would be.
You know what? We've shown, like... history has shown that even the military radar, a lot of people don't even pay as much attention as we think they do. There's been quite a lot of overflights in different places and air intrusions into different places that are supposed to be secure airspace.
Let's go back a few decades. What was it? Matthias Rust? Was that his name?
Right. Rust that landed
a small plane in Red Square in Moscow.
Red Square in Moscow. I mean, come on.
After flying from somewhere in Europe.
Yeah. I mean,
of course, that was many decades ago. Technology presumably improved, but
not that much. I mean, we're still
we're talking like a Cessna or something compared to a 777.
Right. But still, it does beep off a nice radar signature. Okay, you don't know what the heck it is, and you know, what I'm saying is that if people don't monitor radar, especially with blips that don't have data on it, as much as you would think they would.
At least when they're not already in a high state of alert because of some war tension or something.
Yeah.
Like if you're at war, you know, you're going to be looking out for, you know, enemy planes.
Right.
Or missiles or whatever.
Right. Or something.
But if you're not actively at war, it's plausible that you're not paying full attention. Now, a number of these countries have since said they've gone and reviewed all the records and there's nothing there.
Well, Thailand went and said that they did track it. They did say that yesterday. So they confirmed the Malaysian track.
But not after the 8:11 p.m. or whatever.
No.
Yeah.
No. So, I mean...
And, of course, another thing, I just want to point out this. A lot of people, when they released those two arcs... A lot of people misinterpreted those, and I admit for the first few minutes, I wasn't clear either. But those arcs were places where the plane could have been at the moment that it gave that signal to the satellite. Those were not tracks that were traveled by the plane.
Right.
And those were places
right,
that could have been...
It could have been because it's a satellite.
It was places solely based... on the satellite and when it received the information and that kind of timing. So one of the things I mentioned is, you know, you don't have to look against that whole arc. You compare that arc with, you know, with radar data, known flight times, known how fast the plane could go, you could narrow those arcs down significantly to, you know, a much smaller area, probably.
You could, but the problem is, and the Malaysians have also have been, like, not exactly, like, very open and not exactly very open in getting help and, like, tracking the situation.
My point there was
not, and a lot of the military... And then the other thing is that a lot of countries that probably have additional information that could be used may not want to share the information. They may not want to they may want to say, hey, maybe they have no information, but they don't want to say they don't have it.
Right, because then they might be admitting a deficiency in their air
defense. In their defense, right.
Or vice versa, because, like, let's say, anyway, yeah, I mean, although India has come out and said they didn't track it, there are a few others. So, you know, if it suddenly turns up in Pakistan, India is going to have egg on their face potentially, or maybe it went over China to get there. You know, there are other routes. But no, my point was that those two arcs were based solely on the satellite data. You should be able to narrow it down further by combining that with other data. And they didn't say anything about that, which leads me to believe that they're still holding tons back.
Yeah, they got it.
The authorities that are investigating this know a lot more than has been released publicly. At least that's my take on it. Now, I don't think they know exactly where the plane actually is or went or exactly what happened, but they know more than they've announced. And, you know, frankly, if, you know, obviously I asked you to list theories. You didn't do too much of that, but the two main kinds of theories here are, you know, okay,
theory, I have one thing. I mean, somebody did something intentional. Now, where they went and what they did, I can't say.
No, right. The two things here, if we rule out the theory that you spent so much time slagging, which is some kind of mechanical issue that leads to a crash, if you, that was theory number one, that everybody was working on one form or another of that. But then the more recent has been it's intentional. So you've got two choices on the intentional side. One is pilot suicide, essentially. Which has happened. Two is a hijacking, perhaps by the pilot, perhaps by a passenger, but somebody taking the plane and intentionally taking it somewhere else.
Right.
With both of these, you've got sort of different ranges of possibilities. But let's say, for instance, everybody's sort of concentrating on the scariest of these, which is, you know, a terrorist group hijacked the plane. They actually landed it somewhere secret and are keeping it in reserve as a weapon or something. If they did figure out where it was, they wouldn't want to release that information right away. They'd be organizing some sort of effort to go do something where that plane is.
If something happened and the plane crashed and it didn't have a transponder, and it crashed in a very remote location, shit, we may never find this damn plane. It has happened before. Okay. There was a case not that long ago of a 727 that took off in Africa that the guy that had no working transponder, had none of this equipment working. And when the plane crashed, it was never found. Nobody to this day has ever found the plane.
And speaking of intentional, there was another link that I tweeted from Angola, where the plane had actually been retired. It was just sitting on the runway.
I believe that's the one.
Okay, you're thinking about that. Well, this one, there's no proof it ever crashed. The plane took off.
It was never seen again. Yeah,
and who knows? It might have crashed, like you just said, or they might have successfully landed it somewhere and sold off the parts for scrap or something.
Right.
We just don't know.
Right.
Or it was a smaller plane, a 727 or something.
It was a 727.
Which is still a fairly big plane.
That's a fairly big plane.
But, you know, some of the things that people speculated, like, oh, you could use the plane for drug running or something. Well, you know, okay, maybe a little plane. You're not going to use a 777 for drug running.
No. 727 is so damn loud. Okay, all right. I'm gonna sneak into run drugs. Come on, no.
so anyway, so the question is, what is the next thing you do here? I mean, the investigators are looking wherever they can for this thing. They're following every lead they have. But so far, they haven't come up, at least not publicly, with any suspects on the passenger list that are that they are seem to be taking seriously. Although there was one report that I read about a Uyghur separatist being on the plane, and a Uyghur separatist group actually taking credit for this in the first 48 hours after the crash, but them not being taken seriously at first because they didn't think they had the wherewithal to pull this off. And that they thought it was just an accident at this point. And I did read that they're looking at that more seriously again, but there's no smoking gun here yet. That
no.
Whether this is a suicide, whether this is terrorist, whether this is whatever.
But what was the claim by the whatchamacallit? I never can pronounce her.
I think it's pronounced Uyghur.
Uyghur.
The Uyghur.
I used to keep saying Uyghurs, but
I don't know that there was a lot of detail.
Uyghurs, Uyghurs, whatever. Okay, sorry guys. I'm sorry. I can't pronounce your thing. But what was the claim that they made? Do you know?
No.
Did they say no? Okay.
I think it was just we did it.
Okay, just we did it. Hey, it's us. No, okay.
Something along those lines.
Okay. Well.
And of course, one of the northern of those two arcs goes over Uyghur territory in China as well. But. I've tweeted since this happened. I've probably tweeted a dozen different wild ass theories about what's happening here.
I'm going to say this: the southern route makes no sense unless it was just plain suicide.
Right.
Okay. All right.
Unless we're just a second, you know, again, those arcs are only the current position there. Like you could go the southern route and then make another turn and land in Australia somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, true.
Like, following that arc makes no sense. But again, the arc isn't a path of the airplane. It's at a specific time, the plane was somewhere along these arcs. So it's not telling you the direction the plane would have been going at that time or anything. It's just telling you it passed through this spot.
No, I know.
The southern route potentially does make sense, but not the middle of the Indian Ocean, again, unless it's just a suicide. And again, people have pointed out, if it's just a suicide, why the hell would you fly 7 hours? Just point down and be done with it.
I know, which is just the confusing thing about it.
The southern
route, one thing,
landing,
now, another
landing
thing.
In the outback somewhere in Australia is a possibility.
Okay, true. Now, a couple of things, other facts that I forget have come out this week. Everybody's been talking about why no phone calls.
Yeah.
Okay, look, 35,000 feet, there's no cell phone signal, they're in the middle of the water. And here's the other thing. I guarantee you something, that if they did it intentionally, this was a night flight, okay, yeah. All right? Nobody on board would have noticed that anything was going wrong.
Right.
Okay? Most people on those night flights are asleep. Okay. If they just
Alex, we're talking about that missing plane. Do you have anything to add about that? Because I know you've been talking about it. What do you think happened to the plane, Alex?
Train car.
Okay.
Okay.
If you say so.
Alex, I have to take you back downstairs.
Underwater. Went underwater. Poo-poo plane.
Yeah, it went underwater?
Poo-poo plane.
Poo-poo plane, yes. We're going through a phase where calling things poo is very funny. Uh-huh.
Oh, gosh, good Lord.
And how did you say they would have to find it?
God almighty.
Okay. Hey, we're going back downstairs. We will continue this conversation about the plane in just a moment.
You're in the Valley, AM 1620 and LiganAirRadio.com. This is where you'll find your favorite songs. Everybody's doing a brand new dance now.
Go like this. I hit the radio dial and tune it up all the way. I got a dancing in the moonlight.
classic music for a classic American town, AM 1620, and in stereo at LigonierRadio.com, The Valley.
Okay, back here.
So, as I was saying, in a night flight like that, where they take off at midnight, most of the passengers are asleep. Okay, all right? They are not looking out the windows. They are not doing anything. The according to the moves that were made, the changes in the route that were made were not abrupt. There's no way of looking out the window you could have told what the hell was going on.
Unless you're sitting there with a GPS in your hand, or it's one of the planes that has the display of your location, which they could probably turn off from the front.
Which you can turn off. Okay, all right? If they went, they just turned it off, which I've been on flights that have that, but it's not been working during the flight.
And once upon a time, in the early days, before they stopped letting you do it, I actually did sit there through entire flights with a GPS in my hand tracking my flight. But, you know, I'm weird. Most people don't do that.
But most people don't
do that. And right now, of course, they make you put away your devices and stuff. So,
not anymore.
Not anymore. But, like, you know, for the longest time, GPS on some airlines was listed as one of the restricted devices, even though it's not even a transmitter.
There's no transmitter. Just receiving signals.
It's just idiotic.
But people don't do that.
People don't make a habit of doing that.
No. Nobody's sitting there with a GPS looking at and if the air show, you know, showing the route is not on, okay, forget it. You're not going to see where the heck it is. So, you know, and apparently, you know, a lot of these planes have sat phones. But let's face it, if you don't know anything's going on, why the hell are you going to be picking up the phone in the first place? Mm-hmm. And I mean, I don't think that anybody would have suspected. I mean, it would have taken, unless there was a fight on the plane or something or whatever. They could have gone for a very, very long time at night
before someone starts realizing, "Hey, where are you? Know, why aren't we landing?
Why aren't I looking at Beijing down there?" Right.
Now, having said that, there's been a lot of speculation. You mentioned the altitude stuff is unreliable, but this speculation, you know, if you did have terrorists in charge of the plane, like knowing what happened in 9/11, especially with the Shanksville flight, and how basically most hijackings since then have not been successful because the passengers fight back, you know, depressurize the cabin, you know, knock everybody out, kill them, and then you don't have to worry about that anymore.
Well, I mean, you could do that. You know, it's certainly a maneuver to do. You know, but once again, this is pure speculation.
And the fact that there's so little evidence, at least so little public evidence, is why. I mean, everybody's just making up stories to try to fit the facts as best they can. And
the facts we got are very simple. The plane took off. It headed in the direction.
What's wrong? Okay.
It turned away.
Hold on, guy. I'll be right back, Yvonne. I see. Come on. Beep, beep, beep. So what happened there was Alex realized that the bandage he had over his stitches from the injury to his finger that I posted about on abelsmay.com and mentioned last week had come off. And so I took him down to his mom to get rebandaged. No biggie. And then I came back. Doo-doo-doo! Okay, continue, Yvonne. Sorry for...
So what I was saying is that we know the plane took off. I think it's fairly certain at this stage that whatever the heck the reasons why it veered off from the route were intentional, but why, where it headed, and so forth, and anything beyond that, we just don't know. And I think, like as you pointed out, I think that there are people that know more, but for whatever reasons, whether they're national security or something, or secrecy or whatever, or not wanting to reveal certain weaknesses in their security or something, whatever, they haven't said what they know.
Yeah. I mean, I think we'll continue to... I don't know. I mean, this could go two ways. One, sometime in the next few weeks, we'll find out everything.
Yeah.
Two...
never find out.
This becomes one of those mysteries that people are still talking about in 30, 40 years.
Yeah.
You know, and that could happen here. Now, you know, I tweeted at least one person who, there's the perfectly valid point here. If we are under the assumption that it is intentional, if we have no proof of a crash, then you have to look at the possibility that it landed somewhere and it's being prepared for some sort of nefarious use.
Right.
So what happens when sometime in the next 2 or 3 weeks, suddenly an unknown large object shows up on radar over some country somewhere, heading somewhere? Do you shoot it down? What the fuck do you do?
You probably wind up shooting it down. I don't see any other choice.
I mean, I certainly think, you know, all the countries in the region have got to be prepared to, you know, essentially be on high alert. We were talking about earlier how if you weren't on high alert, you might not notice little anomalies and things that aren't where they're supposed to be. I think if you're anywhere in that part of the world, and that we're talking a fairly large chunk of the world, given the radius this thing could have gone, you got to be on alert looking for a plane that just shows up.
Right.
That's not where it's supposed to be.
Right.
And you got to be ready to scramble jets to go find it. And if it's starting heading towards, for instance, a major population area or nuclear power plants or something like that, you shoot the fucker down.
Basically. Yeah, pretty much.
And because, you know, let's put one thing out of the way, I think, for the moment. Let's assume that this was the scenario. It's not like, you know, the whoever's holding the plane would keep all the passengers around and shove them all back on the plane before they did something like that.
It's probably not. Probably kill them all.
Yeah, exactly. Separately. Not load them back into the plane and kill them that way. I mean,
yeah.
Who knows? I mean, again, that's pure rampant speculation, but there are plenty of scenarios out there that don't involve that kind of thing being what happened. Like I said, there's a suicide scenario, and you know, you've presented some good reasons to discount them, but maybe there are some weird combination of mechanical events that could have resulted in something. I don't know.
It would be the most stunning. I mean,
understood. But
right.
Given all the possibilities,
I've got to be prepared
for the worst case.
My odds on the bracket are looking good compared to some of the shit that I've heard.
Anyway, like I said, you have to be prepared for the worst case. You know, and the worst case is someone is weaponizing a 777 out there right now.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, when you talk about this right now, the best case is the pilot committed suicide, killing a whole plane full of people. And that's a pretty bad best case.
Yeah, they're all bad.
I suppose the best case is that it was that one in a million mechanical thing. But, you know, it's still. Or, you know, we could wake up tomorrow and there's been a special forces raid on some remote island somewhere and they rescue all the passengers. But I think the odds of that are much lower still.
Possible. But
everything's possible pretty much. But yep. And this is where, going back to the beginning of this conversation, this is where, you know, as horrible as aircraft incidents are, regardless, this has got to be so much worse for those families. Because it's bad enough, you know, your wife, your husband, your child is dead in a plane crash. That's horrible. I mean, there was a helicopter crash this morning in Seattle that killed a couple people and badly wounded a third. But the family knows exactly what happened. It's right there in front of them. There's a body. You know what happened. It's horrible, but you have that. You know, in this scenario, you've got hundreds and hundreds of family members here who've been on a back and forth and back and forth. Oh, they're missing. Oh, they're dead. Oh, well, the plane kept flying. Oh, it might be terrorism, or it might be this, or we don't know where the plane is. And yeah, you know, oh, maybe it did land. Maybe they're all okay. And you know, they're probably not okay. But still, you've got this whipsaw. It's just, you know, I feel so bad for those people. The families, I mean.
Yeah, I know. Well,
Okay. Wow. Let's take a break and talk Ukraine for just a couple minutes, and then we'll wrap it up. Back after this.
AfricaFocus.org features high-quality analysis and progressive advocacy on African issues with a particular attention to priority issues affecting the entire continent. The heart of the website is the Africa Focus Bulletin. Other features include regularly updated Africa-related news feeds and a set of country pages with extensive background and links on each African country. If you follow African issues or are even curious, visit AfricaFocus.org today.
I think I'm catching your cold, Yvonne.
Oh, great. That's genius.
You know, podcasts are contagious, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so Ukraine. Russia walked in. They, without a shot fired, took over Crimea. Although, you know, Russia still partially sometimes denies that they're there. They put in charge, folks in favor of Russia and the Crimean parliament. Crimea voted to have the parliament voted to have a referendum. They had the referendum. Crimea declared independence. Russia recognized that independence. It's fully expected that and Crimea asked to become part of Russia. It's fully expected that Russia will accept and bring them on board. And all of this, with basically every country in the West sort of impotently yelling, no, no, don't do that, no. And that's where we are, roughly, right?
That's basically where we are. But one of the things today, so everybody's been arguing about sanctions and other stuff and whatever and whatnot, and what the heck we're going to do, what we didn't do. I mean, if you remember like 2008 when the whole thing with Georgia happened, we basically couldn't do anything.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not going to start a war over this shit.
Yeah.
And like we said, like in a podcast a couple of weeks ago, I mean,
and there's not political support for really strong sanctions either.
No, the Europeans can't get their act together regarding whether they do want to do sanctions or not. Listen, we decided. Listen, over the years we've invaded, I don't know, so many places like near our borders, right? I mean, if we went and decided to annex Baja California, for whatever the hell damn reason, for the security of the Americans that are living in Mexico under the drug war, could the Russians do anything about it? No.
And you know, we certainly wouldn't be saying, our own invasion of whatever is a violation of an international law. It's perfectly okay if they put sanctions on us.
Right.
There is indeed this double standard here. Look, at the same time.
Now, be that as it may,
there's always double standards.
There's always double standards. But the one thing about this situation, and everybody's saying, we need all these sanctions. We don't really need to put that much pressure on Russia in order for them to be suffering. As a matter of fact, there's a number of people making their argument right now, which I think makes sense, that one of the reasons why Putin did this is because the Russian economy is really not doing that well.
Even without any explicit sanctions, just some of the investors getting nervous about Russia is probably enough to tip it into a recession. Hell, at least.
Oh, yeah. A big one. And the ruble's value has fallen substantially. Let's face it, you put a significant number of sanctions on some business activity, and the Russians who have made a lot of money are going to get hurt real quick, and they are already starting feeling the pinch. Here's the thing. The Russians need the Europeans more to buy their gas and oil than we need Russia. I mean, so the impact is an economic one in terms of, we're going to have to pay more for fuel. But the reality is that the Russians have been feeling that their influence is waning, especially because U.S. oil production has been soaring. to an extent that it's been causing world prices of oil and gas to flatten or fall. And I honestly think, to a certain extent, that Putin did this in a calculated way in order to gain politically at home. That but was his main.
But let's also look at, like, what are we actually trying to accomplish? Like are we trying to get him to say, "Oh, never mind," and leave Crimea? Are we just trying to stop him from going further into eastern Ukraine? What is the actual live goal here in whatever we do? And the thing that I mentioned this on yesterday's podcast, the thing I think we're in terms of, there's so many people pushing. We have to be, more aggressive. We have to fight back. We have to be stern here or whatever, all that kind of bullshit. But I actually think that the administration is being a little bit too stern because they're making promises they can't deliver on.
Right.
It's like the natural comparison is to the Syria red line stuff. This, if you're going to say this will not stand and there will be consequences and blah, 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 there what better the fucking be consequences, and you better be willing to put yourself behind that.
And otherwise, the problem is
you're hurting yourself by saying it in the first place. Now, I don't want them to be more aggressive and actually carry out on threats. I don't want to be rolling tanks or anything. But I think there's some things, the fundamental thing is you got to admit there's some things that there's just not jack shit you're going to be able to do about it. And then you make the statements. We think this is bad. This shouldn't have happened. Blah, blah, blah. But that's all you can do. So don't try to do more, because that's just going to put you in an even worse position, because you're going to look stupid because you say all this stuff and then nothing happens.
I know. And the problem is that the biggest guys that can actually put economic pressure on Russia is the EU. And they are they don't want to. I mean, they don't want to. So,
let me also, we've mentioned this the last 2 weeks too. While it is certainly true, it is certainly true that this election was complete bullshit. I mean, 96%.
It was a joke.
That was a complete joke. However, everything I've heard about this is if there was a free and fair election, they still would have won.
Now, that's true.
Would be nowhere close to 96%. There is a very significant minority that doesn't want to go. But it is a minority. And I don't know. I don't want to be, in general, I don't want to be in the business of forcing people to be places they don't want to be. Because it's sort of, I understand the notion of we want to hang on to this idea about the inviolability of borders. Because if you don't have that, you have utter chaos all over the place, because there's so many places where people don't really want to be in the countries that they happen to be in at the moment. But at the same time, really, do we want to hold it as an inviolable principle that if people in a certain part of the country really, really don't want to be there, that no matter what, we're going to make them stay there anyway?
Well, I mean, let's face it, we force a Texan to stay.
Yes, we have a history of that. I mean, not to mention, we've got the minority the Kurds, in Turkey, right. Iraq,
right?
You've got all kinds of ethnic minorities in various places that would love to be separate, and believe me, I understand the hey, we want to keep things stable at all costs. But at the same time, look, we the path to follow here, and I said this last week, so apologies for repeating myself. But look, I think the bottom line in whenever you're trying to figure out what's the right thing to do here is how do you avoid this whole thing blowing up into violence? I mean, and there have been a few people shot already just in the last 24, 48 hours. The Russians have shot a couple of people from the Ukrainian military in Crimea. So shots have been fired. Hopefully it won't escalate further. But to me, that's like the bottom line is, what do you do that has the least chance of violence erupting or you know, severe political repression too? Like, you know, you don't necessarily want, okay, Crimea goes because 60% of the people want it to go, but those 40% who are left, oh, they're fucked.
Yeah.
And you know, there have been people saying that that's essentially what's going to happen here, is if you're in the 40% who wanted to stay with Ukraine, your life is going to be absolutely miserable under a Russian Crimea. But again, let's say that's true. What the fuck can we do about it?
Not a hell of a whole lot. I mean, unless we want to go to war with the Russians.
And I think that would be a bad idea.
I would think so, too. I mean, I'm sure we could kick the shit out of them, sure. But, I mean, let's face it. I mean, I know
a lot of people are doing the argument, well, if Putin gets away with this, then he's going to do the Eastern Ukraine next. And if he gets away with that, then he's going to start looking at the Baltic states. And if he...
So he's going to start World War III? I mean, I really don't think so. I don't think that Putin is freaking Hitler, and he doesn't have. Here's a problem: the Russian military is not anywhere nearly as mighty as it used to be. All right,
And after the fall of the Soviet Union, there was all kinds of evidence came out that it was never as mighty as we thought it was anyway.
Exactly. So the reality is that. Look, Crimea would be easy for Russia to take over because it's mostly Russian, and those people want to be a lot of those.
There was honest to goodness real celebration in the streets after the referendum. Right. That wasn't fake.
That wasn't fake. Okay, but that would not be the same case if they went into main Ukraine and like occupying a country of that size. With their troops is going to cost a lot of blood and treasure. And that, let me tell you something. They don't have a GDP anywhere as large as the U.S.
No, if they might be able to carve off a few more pieces of Ukraine, though, that are similar
to not occupy all of Ukraine. Right. And then move on to more countries. I mean, it's just the kind of money. Now,
a number of people have pointed out, though, that the approach to Crimea was really easy for the reasons that you laid out. However, for the rest of the Ukraine, the thing to do at this point is covert ops to destabilize the government and make it so that any attempts they do to make things better for the people, etc., just don't work. And so then in another 2 or 3 years, that government falls anyway, and you put in some of your folks at that point.
That may be, but... that may be, but I don't think that an occupation of, let me put it to you this way. I think that if they did that, I think most of the Ukrainian people would say that this is the Russians' fault. They're not that stupid. Especially, they love conspiracy theories over there. I'm sure that they would be blaming it.
By the way, I should point out, that is the exact sort of tactic that the U.S. used in numerous countries during the Cold War. It generally didn't work either.
It generally didn't work. It did not work. So I'm going to say that and we kept being blamed for a lot of the instability and stuff. So I don't think that that's something that's going to work in the end. So, I just don't see it.
You know, and I will say, forget what I was going to say. This will continue to develop, but I mean, I think the thing that frustrates me the most is just the notion that whenever anything goes wrong anywhere in the world, somehow the U.S. needs to be involved and needs to fix it.
Well, that we're involved, we're always involved. That we need to fix it, that's another fucking story. I mean, we've never been very good at fixing anything anywhere. Let's be realistic.
We tend to make it worse.
Yeah, we tend to make it worse.
There are probably a few exceptions you could pull out, but in most places...
After we went and occupied Japan and Western Europe in World War II, since then, our record has sucked ass. We just terrible. We are no good, okay, at all. At occupying anybody and doing anything.
We did such wonders in Iraq.
Yeah.
And Afghanistan is doing well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that cost like a few trillion. I mean, the thing is that, like I said, I mean, you know, let's face it, an occupation of a country like the size of Ukraine would probably cost the Russians like $400 billion a year. They can't afford to. They can't afford it. It will make them bankrupt. Simple as that.
So do you buy that eventually these actions, they may have a short-term strengthening effect on Putin, but long-term, this actually weakens Putin?
Somebody was comparing these actions today, like the actions of the Argentine junta that was leading Argentina that launched the invasion on the Falklands, okay? Right. Their economy had been shitty, and the popularity had been waning. So they wanted to divert the attention of the people. They said, "Screw it, let's invade the Falklands. The hell with it. Everybody wants to take the damn Falklands away from the British. Everybody will be all for it." It's kind of like this thing with the Ukraine. So you whipped up this fervor all of a sudden, but when reality sinks in after this whole shit, you know, the economy's in a recession and stuff is worse than before. I think this is a short-term boost.
Of course, they also got their asses kicked, which is probably not going to happen to Putin.
No, he's not going to get his ass kicked, but at the same time, the short-lived like buzz that you get from this is not going to be long-lasting, is my point.
Right, and to put an example closer to home... George W. Bush's approval ratings at the time of the invasion of Iraq were through the roof high.
Right. Yeah.
You know, the remember, people were knocking down statues. The first couple weeks, it looked like everybody was welcoming us with open arms, mission accomplished, all of that. And then over the rest of his presidency, that continually deteriorated so that he left his presidency with some of the worst ratings of any president leaving office that in memory. Yeah. You know, but at the time that, you know, he was busy... Well, first of all, 9/11, but then at the time he was invading Iraq, he got a pop in his approval ratings and was the highest it had been since 9/11, which was the highest ever recorded for a U.S. president, pretty much. Right. This is what happens, and maybe that's what we're seeing here. I read all the hawks on this, and I'm like, you know, I can sort of see where you're coming from, but I don't think you're seeing the real world. Any more that the hawks in the 80s were truly understanding the situation in the Soviet Union either.
Right.
Because you know, and lots of people, perhaps correctly, give Ronald Reagan credit for putting the additional pressure that caused the Soviet Union to crumble. But the people pushing for that at the time weren't thinking, hey, all we need is a little bit extra push here and the Soviet Union's going to crumble from inside and that'll be it. That's not the thought process at all. They were, we have to be strong to defend against the Soviet Union because they're a really big threat. They're a really big whatever. And they were fundamentally wrong about what was going on there, which was, in fact, that it was a very, very weak regime that was hanging on by a thread that was able to be pushed over like that. And maybe we have something similar here. I don't know.
I don't know. I don't know if that's the case with Putin. I don't think he's like at a weakness moment at this point.
No, from all reports, you know, aside from, you know, the minority who are against him, he's very, very popular right now. Russian population as a whole, and again, broad generalizations here, but they miss the feelings of respect and authority they had during the Soviet Union days and are nostalgic for it. That's a very strong feeling, and Putin brings some of that back for them. So he is very popular right now. You know, if you want to do the Hitler analogy, you know, that is the kind of, and not everything else about Hitler, but that is part of his appeal, was that Germany was crushed during the First World War. They had a horrible economic situations, and the Nazi Party started bringing back, you know, a feeling of respect and power and whatever. And so they were very popular.
Right. But now, but we all know how those turned out. So anyway.
Yeah, and again, to do the same defense Hillary Clinton did when she mentioned Nazis in conjunction with Putin, I am not in any means saying, you know, Hitler did this, therefore Putin is just like that and is going to do
and
this.
There's some
relevant similarities, but there are lots and lots of things that are incredibly different too.
Well, let's just say one thing, that economic power, relatively, Germany was far more economically powerful in relative terms than the Russians are at this point. That's one very important thing to consider. So, anyway.
Anyway, I'll end this the same way I ended last week. I just hope that whatever, everybody still keep your heads calm. Concentrate on like not letting this blow up into a violent conflagration.
War.
There's so many people who seem like they want that. I mean, the Ukrainian prime minister at this point is like, we have now moved into the armed struggle part of this situation or something like that, because of the Ukrainian military guy who was shot today. But no.
A war is not going to solve this. I don't think a war is going to solve this. And if it were me, I would not be committing military resources trying to retake the Crimea. But I will tell you this, that I sure as heck would have my resources defending the most important parts of the rest of my territory. And I tell you what, that I'd make sure that if the Russians tried to go and roll, they would get a significant pushback.
What do you think about things like offering the rest of Ukraine NATO membership and offering additional Eastern European countries that access? Because we've held back from that so far.
At this point, that's just ridiculous. At this point, I think that would be an overt
escalation.
I don't think it's a good moment to do that at this point.
I think everything here should be about de-escalation at this part. What can be done to reduce the tensions here? And that doesn't mean getting Crimea back. That doesn't necessarily mean anything in particular in terms of what the territorial situation is and who's government of this and who's government of that. It just means, what can we do to calm people the fuck down and keep people from killing each other?
Well, that
includes in the territory of Crimea. You want to avoid anything that would lead to, like I was saying, this is the 60-40 split. You don't want to avoid the retaliation against the 40%. You want to avoid in the rest of Ukraine people doing things to the Russian minority. No. That's what you want to avoid at all costs.
Okay. All right. Well,
on that cheery note.
Yes,
let's wrap this up. Thank you all for joining us for yet another Curmudgeon's Corner. You know how to get a hold of us. Yvonne's I Am Bo on Twitter. I'm Abelsmay at Twitter. And you can reach me at abelsmay@abelsmay.com on email as well. And have a good week, everybody, and we'll talk next time. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.